Hi, I'm Peter Clark. This is Inside Language with the linguist Kate Burridge. Hi, Kate.
Hello, Peter.
Good to see you again. I've been asking for some time, perhaps boring you blind, does English have a true synonym or true synonyms, plural? This is a complex question. It seems simple on the surface. Let's tackle this one. If we take words like tiny, little, small, they seem similar, but as you parse them, get down into them, they each have a slightly different meaning or a different weight of some sort.
Which one do you think is smaller?
Tiny?
Tiny, yes. If you want to make tiny even tinier, you go teeny, which is interesting because then you go an even higher vowel. So there's this interesting link with between high vowels, those made very high in the mouth near the palate, and smallness. And that works across languages, not just English. So, and if you want to make little even littler, you go little, a little bit.
Do we have true synonyms in the English language, which I guess requires you now to tackle this word synonym? What does synonym actually mean?
Yes, well, that would be identity of meaning, which I don't believe we have. And why would we? Why would a language want words that are identical? It doesn't make sense, really. And of course, as we've explored in this program before, words along the way will anyway pick up associations, and that will arise out of people's, I don't know, their experiences, their beliefs. You know, the associations I have with certain words might be different from yours. It's very, very complex. This is the area of, you know, connotations, the word associations, the kind of baggage that words have. So it's be extremely unlikely that you're going to get identity, you know, at that level.
But we have these great constellations of vocabularies which seem to tackle the same area. And when we go and write or go to our thesaurus to get the right word, we juggle those things, don't we?
We do, but they, you know, do they ever agree entirely in, say, evaluative meaning or stylistic meaning? Sometimes it can be different dialects, but if you take, look, a simple example of cheap versus inexpensive, that's a very clear one, that cheap isn't inexpensive and inexpensive isn't cheap, and yet, you know, you will often find them described or cross-referenced in dictionaries. Then you've got an example, say, of, oh, I don't know, black eye versus circumorbital hematoma can refer to the same thing, but, you know, they're worlds apart. And that goes to a very, I suppose, a clear aspect of English vocabulary, and that is we do have these stylistic layers, and we've had that ever since we started pinching words from French and from the classical languages, so from Latin and from Greek. So at the very base, so I sometimes use a carpet analogy here. I don't know whether it works that well, but if you think of the sort of underlay of a carpet, it's basic, you know, core vocabulary in this case is English, so Germanic, you know, everyday grammatical words, everyday words, really. And this supports a carpet of French words of greater refinement or nuance. And then on top of that carpet, you've got little scatter rugs, you've got which are the classical words, you know, the Greek and Latin. So a good example might be, I don't know, rise is English, mount is French, ascend is Latin. That's a very straightforward example. Or you've got, you know, leech, old leech, quack, these were early English terms for doctor. Doctor's French. Physician is, well, Latin in origin, but came to us via French. And English is just, it's just soaked with these kinds of stylistic differences.
And the Greek words as well.
That's right.
Exactly. For scientific things,
yes.
For, obviously, as scientists coming out of the Enlightenment, I guess particularly, started to name things and concoct words for discoveries they were making, they drew upon Latin a lot and on Greek a lot.
Yes, also in an effort to sort of make English look a bit more respectable as well. And of course, there are a lot of Greek and Latin affixes. And then there was the backlash against that. And just as an aside, there was this attempt to get rid of the word synonym and bring back mate word or create mate word, you know, a good Anglo-Saxon word.
Is the fact that English has so many words, a huge vocabulary compared to French, and of course the French resist adding English words particularly, and words from other languages, I'm thinking the French even resist a lot of what's happening in computers and in the digital revolution. They don't like the word Wi-Fi, they don't like the word email, they're trying to create French words for those.
Yes.
But the fact that English has such a large vocabulary, is that significant?
Most certainly. And I love that description that David Crystal uses of English, you know, a vacuum cleaner of language. It's been sucking up words from languages and has been doing that for centuries. So it's never had a problem, really, with borrowing other words. But that's what's created these, yes, huge groups of words that are very close in meaning but differ in matters of style or value. Or
when I look up a dictionary, let's leave the thesaurus aside just for a moment. When I look up a dictionary, essentially I'm looking for the denotation, what we call the denotation, that that harder, narrower meaning of a word, a symbol, a written symbol, or an oral symbol if we speak the word. So I'm looking for the baseline meaning of that word, the denotation.
The sort of sense that's constantly associated with that word, that's right. But so you could have, for instance, I don't know, the word dog, but then you can have mutt, you can have canine, you can have dish licker, you can have pooch, you can have, you know, hound. All can denote, you know, the canine quadruped, but they're all hugely different in their connotations.
When you said canine quadruped, that was rather Latin.
Yes.
Very Latin, in fact. And it seems more definitive. When you say canine quadruped, you've really defined a dog, haven't you?
Well, that's one way of doing it. Yes, that's right. But there, an interesting thing there, because, of course, if we want a classy adjective, we use Latin canine versus English doggy. You know, there's worlds apart between, you know, doggy and canine.
Stylistically? But what about in terms of the sheer meaning of all those things? Aren't they interchangeable to some degree?
Well, to some degree, but, you know, you may not want your pooch to be called a mutt or a cur or a whelp, or, you know, there are all these negative words for dog. Now, dog is perhaps the most neutral.
Doggy is obviously more affectionate, so instantly we have another layer on top of that. Mm. Okay, I'm looking up the dictionary and I get denotations, then I get usage. I'm starting to get now into connotations. And these are the more difficult ones, aren't they? Words have baggage that arise, I guess, out of usage over a long time. Different people have bent these words, actually use them in certain ways, in certain contexts, and stylistically. So you've got the denotation, that more defined meaning, but then you've got all the connotations. So every word has this little cloud around it.
That's right. It's a good way of describing it. These associations that attach themselves to the words and can sometimes overtake. I mean, if a word will acquire negative associations, then it often will, you know, deteriorate further and become something very negative with time.
This seems to me, Kate, to have enormous implications for translation, say from French to English or German to English or Russian to English, because all those languages have their own denotations and connotations. Right. So we're trying to wrestle these symbols together in a translation. Some people say there's no such thing as a true translation. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, well, I think it would be impossible. Of course, it will depend on what languages are involved, how close they are, not just linguistically, but also culturally and socially, because it's a huge problem to try to get a word that will coincide in every aspect of that word's meaning. It's tricky. Sometimes you have to resort to, you know, some sort of awkward circumlocution, some sort of, you know, a number of words to describe that if that concept is not in the language. Or then, of course, you can borrow the word as well, or you can use the word, that sometimes, but, you know, that will depend on the language too, whether that's easy enough to do.
In food writing, for example, the French tends to intrude quite a lot, and sometimes the French word is exactly the right word as well for that moment, for that context.
Yes, usually. I mean, it's interesting that French, you know, has been applying this kind of lovely French dressing to English culinary terms for years now, and it's interesting to compare the English. If you think of words like beef or veal or pork, those are French words, and so you can have veal medallions, for example, and you can have or pork medallions. But you know, when you're using inferior cuts like the pig's trotter, then you use pig. you wouldn't say pork trotter. It sounds like a clash of styles, doesn't it? It's really interesting. You know, calves foot jelly, you use calf, not veal, if you're using those really unattractive and old, perhaps now old-fashioned. I don't know whether people eat calves foot jelly anymore.
The other thought I've had is that we have clusters, constellations of words, vocabularies, which describe very common everyday things like distance and the geography around us, space, time, people. We have a lot of words that we've grown up with over the years and the languages as it's evolved. It's hard for me to imagine that some of those aren't so similar that you could call them truly synonyms. I've just been to both New Zealand and Tasmania, and it really tickled us that down in Tasmania, down from here in Melbourne, creeks just weren't there. There was hardly a creek we saw in terms of signage, but there are a lot of rivulets. We went to New Zealand, hardly a creek, hardly a rivulet, but lots of streams. So things like streams and brooks and rivulets and creeks.
They're different regional forms, so we're dealing with different dialectal forms here, so, and that they don't coincide exactly either, do they? So if I were to use the word brook, then that would have all sorts of extra meaning for me. That would be, I would immediately imagine a British landscape with a babbling brook and lots of green, and I wouldn't imagine a brook in an Australian landscape, would you?
Well, maybe in Tasmania.
Yes, that's true. Would they call it brook?
I've seen the odd brook here and there, and we did cross the River Rubicon down there, which was quite a wide, very green, what I would call a river. But sometimes streams or brooks of similar size are called rivulets there. It seems very variable. So Kate, tell me, when I dive into my thesaurus, what am I actually doing? I'm looking for a word that fits, but what's going on there?
It can be quite tricky, can't it? Because I had the experience of my young son the other day who was looking for, I suppose he wanted slightly more, you know, better sounding words, and he dived or dove into his thesaurus, and he wanted another word for neglect. So he found dereliction, and he used it. And of course, what your thesaurus doesn't tell you is that a word like dereliction is probably not used that much in a general context. You've got dereliction of duty. It's almost like that fixed phrase, which made me think that that word is probably on the way out. Often happens that they will linger, but in fixed expressions, they become sort of fossils.
It comes down to context, yes, doesn't it? It does come down to the little feelings, the little extra edges that you're trying to bring into a sentence or into a paragraph, into an essay. So is that what we're doing? We're actually cherry-picking words out of the thesaurus to use them in a certain way, strictly in context.
Yes, exactly. Or the context is all in that. And in the case of this dereliction, it really was inappropriate. It sounded peculiar because it was used in a more general context. But the thesaurus, I think, is been one of the most successful reference works of its kind. It's first appeared in the, I think, early 1800s, and it hasn't been out of print. This is Roget's thesaurus. Thesaurus, by the way, originally meant something like treasure trove, and it was used more generally of dictionaries. So, you know, word hoard or word treasury. So, and then it took on that more specific sense where words are organized into different semantic fields.
As the English language, according to Crystal, continues to vacuum up more and more words, isn't it more likely that there are going to be words which are very, very close in meaning?
Well, you're right. There are some words that are very, very close. I was thinking, actually, just a little earlier when you were talking about the stylistic differences, how sometimes you get, I was thinking of actually words for drunkenness, and there you get overwhelmingly kind of English words. So words like smashed and stewed and sloshed, and they're pretty interchangeable. And we've got very few that of the posh classical. Inebriated, I think, is one of the few posh-sounding words for drunkenness. So you get those interesting different areas where different stylistic words will cluster. But they'd be fairly close, those two, wouldn't they?
And as the English comedian Michael McIntyre points out, if you're upper class, you can use any word for inebriated. I was absolutely umbrellaed. And everyone knows what you mean.
It's beautiful, yes.
Kate, great to see you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Kate Burridge is Professor of Linguistics at Monash University here in Melbourne, Australia. I'm Peter Clark for Inside Language. Until next time.